Willkommen bei einer neuen Episode von Markenkraft. Für alle, die von Marken fasziniert und für ihr Wohlergehen verantwortlich sind. Welcome to another episode of Markenkraft. My name is Olaf Hartmann and I have the great pleasure to speak today with Paul Feldwick. Paul worked in the celebrated advertising agency BMP, mainly as a brand planner originally, and after its merger with DDB, he led its global strategy and training for many years. He has a master's degree in organizational consulting, a diploma in organizational development, a Gestalt perspective from the Metanoia Institute. He has a master of science from the University of Bath in responsibility and business practice, and he's a certified executive coach. He was convener of judges for the IPA Advertising Effectiveness Awards, chaired the Account Planning Group and the Association of Qualitative Research Practitioners. Today, he is a freelance brand consultant, thinks, lectures, and writes with deep insight and skill on advertising. He recently has written two unique books asking the question, how does advertising work? Does it have to attract conscious attention in order to transmit a unique selling proposition? Or does it insinuate emotional associations into the subconscious mind? Or is it just about being famous? Or maybe something completely different? What role does creativity play in the effectiveness of advertising? Is the cult of creativity in the advertising industry justified, or do we need another type of creativity to keep advertising relevant and effective in a digital age? These two books contain an amazing scope of insights, how to think and how to understand advertising, and which I am very excited to talk to you about today with Paul. Welcome, Paul. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Olaf.
To warm up, I have a quick fire round of questions. Just answer as you like. Mountain man or sea lover?
Oh, sea lover, I'd say.
All right. Beer or wine?
Wine, but not exclusively.
All right. On your website, you have a beautiful picture with a glass of red wine. What's your favorite?
It depends on the circumstances, but in this summer weather, I've been drinking a lot of white and indeed quite a lot of rosé.
All right. Yeah, I'm gonna be in the south of France soon, and there's the rosé, the thing to do. Huh? Fame or fortune?
To be honest, I've got as much of either as I really reasonably want, and I'm happy with that.
Advertising, art or craft?
Oh, I think craft is a much better place to start from.
We come back to that. I like that answer. Intuition or big data?
Well, I'm not against data. But the expression big data does sort of worry me a bit. And I'm a fan of intuition.
Misfit or team player?
I think I'm best as a team player, to be honest.
And in a team, like, would you want misfits or only team players?
I think a team needs to play as a team, actually. I think the two things are not really in opposition. I guess if you're too much of a misfit, it can be a problem.
Yeah, I see. But sometimes you do need the original perspective in a team to make the team effective, huh?
Sure, like that's all part of being a team, an effective team. A team is not about everyone agreeing with each other.
There you go. If everybody agrees, people haven't thought hard enough. I don't know who said it, but I heard that before, and that makes a lot of sense. Easy one, Porsche or Tesla?
Oh, I suppose from now on, the head is saying Tesla, but I never had a Porsche. So, the heart is still thinking that would be fun.
Yeah. USP or purpose?
I'm sorry? Oh, USP
or purpose?
Well, if we have to choose one of those, I'll go for USP.
different or distinct?
Well, in the context we're going to talk about, I'd say distinct is more important.
Great. What was the first job that you were ever paid for? Like, what was the first money that came into your hands?
Oh, wow. I'm not quite sure exactly what came first, but it would be something fairly trivial, maybe doing a bit of part-time work in my father's the factory in the accounts department where my father worked when I was a teenager. But nothing very significant.
Yeah, and you remember what you spend the money on?
Probably an LP or something.
You were into music then?
Yeah.
So what was your first experience? Now we get to the topic that we want to talk about. What was your first experience, personal experience with brands? Like, how did you get in touch with the concept of brand? Or you remember how you perceived it for the first time?
Oh, gosh, the concept of brands. I don't know, it's quite an abstract concept, brands. Mm-hmm. Do ordinary people really think about brands, I wonder? One memory comes to mind, which is perhaps relevant. And it goes back to when I was still at school, or maybe I just about left school and started university. And I remember seeing a press ad for Jaguar. You asked me about Porsche and Tesla. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if there was one car in the past that I always liked, it was the Jaguar. And this was a very simple one-page press ad. You can probably find it online if you look hard enough. I think I have. And it just showed a schoolboy standing outside a Jaguar showroom, and he'd parked his bicycle, and he was staring in through the plate glass window at the new Jaguar XJ6 or whatever it was. And there was no writing on the ad except the headline, which just said, "Someday, someday." And I remember that struck me at the time, because even then I thought, that's how I've always felt about Jaguars. And, you know, maybe 20 years after that, I finally got the opportunity to own a Jaguar. And it was just something I had wanted since I was, you know, since I was quite small. And I think everything about Jaguar as they used to be, I fear the mark has lost it now to a large extent, as far as I'm concerned anyway. But, you know, Jaguar for me is was from very early on a kind of example of what the irrational appeal of a brand could be, you know, just in the beauty of its design, the beauty of the logo, and just everything about it just made you think, this is exciting. I want this. And it's difficult to put into words, but the ad didn't try to put it into words. It just acknowledged that this was how you would feel about it.
Oh, you did, but you did very well, because there's something that strikes me in that picture is that brands is also about reaching people who are not in the market, and you weren't in the market for another 20 years.
Absolutely. No, I mean, at that time, I was long before I even had a car of any sort, and long before I could aspire to having a Jaguar.
And nevertheless, it planted the seed, which then in a moment of need would be a little bit exaggerated, but in a moment of what is it means, you would say, to be in the position to buy a car, suddenly, yeah, the brand is still in your relevant set, and
that's right.
And that's something that I think many brands today have forgotten, that this is something, probably the most important value that brands deliver, is that they put the seeds in the ground that will blossom later. And you just need a lot of patience. But that's what we're talking about. Like, this is a good example of effective advertising. Like, the reason why I'm talking to you today is because those two books, I read them, I bought the first one, I finished it, and I was just blown away by like the way you described, and I would like to talk about like the different like you have such a deep historical knowledge about how advertising came about and what it means today. So I would like to start there with that question. Tell us how, like, what is advertising? Like, how did you come about to write the first book, which is called The Anatomy of Humbug, and it's about how advertising has developed and what it does today and what the anatomy of it is.
I joined BMP in 1974, not really knowing what I wanted to do, and I stayed in the agency for 30 years, which was great, and I had a lot of interesting times. BMP, right from the time I joined it, and indeed before, was an agency that produced work that was very entertaining. A lot of the ads will be forgotten now because it's nearly 50 years ago, but they were very popular, very entertaining ads. A lot of them used humor, or some of them were sort of emotionally appealing in other ways. But they were very funny, very popular, very creative ads in their sense that I like to use that word. And yet, I found that the processes that we were expected to use for creating advertising had very little to do with any of that and seemed much more based on, you know, why is this product better, on ideas of rational persuasion, on what is the proposition or what is the consumer benefit. And it was like that there were these very, very different ways of thinking about advertising. I mean, I'm slightly post-rationalizing because it took me many years for this thought to kind of crystallize in my mind, I suppose. But I began more and more to notice that there was a real sort of disconnect between what we were actually trying to do in our agency and what we thought good advertising looked like and what all the conventional wisdom and indeed a lot of the clients, you know, seemed to believe was what advertising was all about, which was giving you reasons, giving you facts, giving you arguments.
To persuade, like to really be convincing about something.
Yeah, to be convincing rather than seducing, if you like. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that problem emerged for me more and more clearly over the years. And it began to explain why it often proved to be so difficult to create advertising, why there were so many arguments about it, because I noticed that people would be arguing from completely different premises. You know, creative people or the agency might be arguing, saying, you know, we like this ad because it's really funny. And the client would kind of not understand why that was important at all. They would almost see that as a bad thing. And they'd say, no. This needs to be a good ad because it explains why our product is better. So that they're coming from very, very different fundamental assumptions about how advertising works. And it's not necessarily that one was absolutely right and the other was absolutely wrong, because both contain part of the truth. But nobody understood even that they were starting from very different points of view. And so, of course, the arguments would go on, and they'd often end up with an uneasy compromise, and the ads would not be very good as a result. So when I suppose what then fed into that was I started finding out a bit about some of the history of advertising and how it had been done, which was not a subject that anybody seemed very interested in at all. I mean, the attitude in ad agencies was always, you know, nothing in the past is relevant to us. It's all new and exciting, and, you know, it's year zero. And, you know, we know everything we need to know. But it was when I found books like Martin Mayer's book from the 1950s, wonderful contemporary account of the New York advertising world or the American advertising world, Madison Avenue, USA. And I suddenly realized that all the things that I'd sort of been taught to take for granted as sort of absolute truths were nothing of the sort, that they just happened to be particular theories or particular points of view that particular advertising practitioners of the past had come up with at a point in time and had promoted or written about or whatever. So, you know, all these sort of concepts like why is it important to have ad recall, or what is the nature of a proposition and why does it matter? These were not absolute God-given truths. They were just particular points of view that particular people had. And the more I dug into that past, and I discovered that nobody else was terribly interested in it. So, I mean, you're kind enough to say that I had a great in-depth understanding of advertising history. I honestly don't think even today I have a profoundly in-depth understanding of it, but I have more than most people in the business. So that's probably enough.
Totally agreed. And it seems to be the same thing like in Germany. It seems to be the same situation like you just described. Nobody is interested in the past of advertising. Yeah. And there is so much interesting also in German, like theory about brand building, like Hans Domitzloff and people like that. They've been thinking deeply in the 1920s and 30s about what brands are and how do they work, like mass psychology. And just before I let you go on, I just wanted to point out one thing. The beginning of the book, there was one quote in there by James Hillman that just blew me away, because it describes exactly what you just talked about, and I reused it since then about a dozen times. Ideas we have and do not know we have us.
Yes.
So what you just described is like that people that what you were realizing that you were acting upon premises, upon certain beliefs of people, but you didn't even know that you were acting upon those beliefs.
That was absolutely the point that I started from. And when you do not recognize the assumptions that you're making, then you cannot begin to criticize them. They may be right, they may be wrong, or they may be useful in some circumstances, they may not be useful in other circumstances. But as long as you don't know what assumptions you're making, then you are totally imprisoned by them.
And I recognize that from current discussion, like what you just mentioned, like the you call them narratives that lead the discussion, like the Enlightenment narrative. You want to explore that a little bit?
To take the example of narratives, I think that again, I suppose narratives are also an example of this, that the sort of unspoken beliefs, which are just sort of so taken for granted. And actually, if you challenge them, you are regarded very often as being heretical. The narrative that I find most sort of irritating about advertising at the moment is this sort of, there's a narrative that goes, all advertising was really sort of boring and rubbish until Bill Birnbach came along. And then he suddenly showed us all how to do wonderful creative advertising and everything became wonderful. And I more and more distrust this narrative. I think it's not just fundamentally mistaken. I think it's actually dangerous, but it's quite complicated to explain why. I mean, but first of all, you have to acknowledge that people were doing very entertaining, popular, emotional advertising many, many decades before Birnbach, as well as since. You also have to acknowledge that a lot of what Birnbach and his agency did was actually not that popular or even particularly successful. Outside of Volkswagen, there are... It's very hard to find sort of campaigns that were lasting or popular that DDB did back in its so-called glory days. So the whole thing is based on a number of sort of assumptions that when you challenge them, turn out to be very questionable, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I think that what Birnbach set up was a very dangerous idea in advertising, somehow creating advertising that advertising people think is stylish and sophisticated and cool is the most important thing. And occasionally, you can do advertising that's stylish and sophisticated and cool, but also happens to be popular and effective. But actually, what we've seen over the last 50 years is that increasingly those things are at odds with each other, and that advertising, that the advertising village approves of, the stuff that increasingly, you know, tends to win the creative awards or that the creative people themselves value, is very different from the stuff that actually works. I mean, I say there can be an overlap. I think a lot of the work we did at BMP, and it was a bit different back in the 70s and 80s. A lot of the things that won creative awards in those days were actually very popular campaigns as well, and very effective campaigns. The two things have now become more and more apart. And I think that's been a very gradual process. And again, it's happened so gradually that we've hardly been aware of what's going on. But we now end up with a situation where to create advertising that is popular, genuinely popular, is almost considered a bad thing. I've just published an article, incidentally, and it's published in an online magazine called MediaCat. I've just published an article about the famous campaign for Charmin toilet tissue that featured Mr. Whipple. And Whipple is best known today, probably from the title of Luke Sullivan's book, Hey Whipple, Squeeze This. The interesting thing to me is that Luke Sullivan starts that book in the very first chapter by taking that campaign, and he takes Mr. Whipple as an example of everything that's wrong with advertising. He says, you know, this is a schmaltzy cornball campaign.
Could you
like
just,
that.
because we have lots of German listeners that probably don't know the campaign, could you just summarize the campaign real quick?
Well, it was an American campaign, and I don't think anybody outside America, or indeed, I think many Americans under the age of 40 won't know it either. Mm. But it was, it was a ridiculous idea. That it's for a brand of toilet tissue that was meant to be very soft. And the campaign started in 1964. And the copywriter had this idea that at that time, you know, women would go to the supermarket, they'd squeeze the vegetables, they'd squeeze the bread to see if it was fresh and so forth. He said, maybe they would squeeze the toilet paper as well. So he set up this ridiculous, and I mean, they then turned that into something I think very funny, that they invented a grocery store manager called Mr. Whipple, who was continually having to tell his customers, please don't squeeze the Charmin, because they were always coming in and wanting to squeeze the toilet paper. And he'd have to say, please don't squeeze the Charmin. And then when he'd driven them away, the kind of punchline was he'd always have to go and squeeze it himself because he couldn't resist squeezing it. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's absurd. And, you know, the point was that campaign was unbelievably successful. It ran for 20 years. The guy who played Mr. Whipple became a celebrity. He was regarded as the second best known face in the United States after the president himself. And it was revived even, you know, years later. And eventually when he died, P&G still ran the old ads and said, he'll be forever in our hearts. I mean, it was hugely popular. So why does Luke Sullivan choose this as an example of everything that's wrong with advertising? Well, basically, I mean, he finds some evidence, and I don't dispute that this evidence exists, that, you know, during the time that this campaign was running, and it would have been very ubiquitous, if you did research into, you know, what do people see as the most annoying TV campaigns, they'd come up with the Whipple campaign. And so you go, oh, this is annoying people. So this is the sort of advertising that we mustn't do, which is not completely irrelevant. But to be honest, it's not the main point, because the thing is, the campaign worked. It created an incredibly powerful distinctive asset in Whipple and in the, you know, the line, please don't squeeze the Charmin.
And it drives home the key selling point in the end.
And it even communicated a USP about the squeeziness, you know, and the softness. Yeah. So it kind of did everything. Now, of course, you know, Procter & Gamble have never been fashionable. Benjamin Bowles, who did the campaign, have never been a fashionable agency. The campaign is ridiculous. It's easy to understand why people went, oh, it's annoying, oh, it's silly, oh, it's stupid, oh, it's unbelievable. Of course, it's all those things, but it's actually quite funny. But most importantly, it's distinctive, it's memorable, and it sold toilet paper, and it built that brand. Now, if creative people today are starting from the premise that the most important thing is don't do anything that looks like Whipple, which they largely are being taught to do, you know, then
which explains the point
in the wrong direction.
Right, and which explains the point that recently there was an analysis of Cannes awarded campaigns and how effective they were, and they have been the least effective ever. Like the awarded campaigns in Cannes, they don't sell anymore. So you must be friends with Steve Harrison, huh? Like he's driving home this point, like can't sell, won't sell, very strongly. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I know Steve, and I've talked to Steve. I think we actually have sort of different views about what's really important in creating effective advertising, although I think we're probably both right. But I think what we absolutely agree on is that creative awards have lost touch with reality. And I think we also both agree on this sort of currently fashionable idea of brand purpose is very largely bullshit. One but way this, or another.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, in the way it's practiced, it is another massive distraction from creating advertising that is genuinely sort of popular and effective.
Right. I would like to pick up on one point which you just mentioned. Like you have different opinions and you're probably both right. That's something that I liked about your book very much, is like that you bring together so many perspectives. You used in Why Does the Peddler Sing, I'm not sure, correct me if I'm wrong, you used the metaphor of the elephant, you know, the wise men in the dark that touch the elephant, and everybody has to say, what is it? And everybody gives a different answer.
That's actually in Anatomy of Humbug, but and that actually, that's it's an ancient Buddhist story. I mean, I took it from an American poem from the 19th century, but the original story of the elephant is actually an ancient Buddhist tale from an early, you know, the Pali canon of Buddhism, I think.
Would you humor us to tell it for the people that don't know it?
I'll tell you the sort of the original version, if you like. And it was like there was a prince who brought together a group of blind men to examine an elephant, and each of them touches a different part of the elephant and says the elephant is like this. So one touches the tail and says, ah, the elephant is like a rope. And another touches the ear and says the elephant is like a leaf. And another walks into his side and says the elephant is like a wall. And then, this is the original sort of ancient version, which is actually rather more violent, which says, and so these blind men fell to blows and started beating each other up, shouting, you know, I am right and you are wrong, and I am right and you are wrong. And the point of this whole exercise was to demonstrate from a Buddhist point of view that as we each become attached to our own idea of what we think is right and deny everybody else's idea of what we think is right, so we just create pointless conflict and suffering. And I think that's quite a profound thought, and not just applicable to advertising, but it does very nicely apply to advertising because, you know, I mean, if I become too attached to the idea, which I mean, is the central idea in Why Does the Peddler Sing? And I say, well, advertising has got a great deal to do with entertainment. And I wanted to stress that because I wasn't aware that anybody else had really come right out and said that. Everyone in advertising historically has been slightly embarrassed by the idea that advertising might ever be entertaining. And indeed, many, many people have said, well, advertising shouldn't be entertaining. You know, Claude Hopkins said, you know, never be frivolous. People do not patronize a clown. David Ogilvy said, do not sing your sales message, and Sergio Zimon says advertising that entertains does not work and all this sort of stuff, which is, I mean, I think this is tosh, but, you know, so I say, well, actually, a lot of advertising works precisely because it is entertaining.
But interesting. I'd like to explore that a little bit, because, like, I think this train of thought leads us to a very good conclusion, like you describe in the book. But it's important to understand those different perspectives. Like, if we translate that elephant metaphor now on advertising, like, could you describe what is the trunk, what is the tail, what are the ears of the elephant in advertising?
Oh, I mean, I don't know if I can elaborate it quite that cleverly off the top of my head, although it would be possible to do it. But just to continue my train of thought, you know, as I say, entertainment for me is really important and needs to be talked about. And that's why I stress it in this book. If you read Steve Harrison's book about, you know, how to write advertising, he is much more about, you've got to explain why the product is better.
Right.
And I mean, he comes from a direct marketing background, essentially. And he's very successful in what he does. You know, he's a great copywriter. You know, I don't want to say any of that is wrong, but that is working in a very different way. It may be complementary. It may be something that can be made to overlap. But again, if you just say that's all advertising does, and you ignore other perspectives, then I think you are missing something really, really important. So this is why I think we come from different backgrounds, and we probably stress different things.
The difference is like that? It's like more like a funnel difference, that he comes from direct advertising, which is often at the end of the funnel. It's like about selling, about giving the last push. And what you talk about in brand building, where you create emotion and a certain positive prejudice towards a brand, that is more, in that way, it's more important to create an emotional connection early on, like you described with the Jaguar ad. And then later his salesmanship comes in, that sends you that letter that sells you the lease rate in the right moment with the new model, and it just does the kill, and both is right.
But again, but I mean, you're right. And I mean, that's there's a lot of truth in what you've just said. But again, it's even that is kind of oversimplification, because I think you can, in many ways, you do sort of create the prejudice towards a brand by giving facts sometimes. So, you know, the two things are not quite so completely distinct. And I think I'm always aware when I'm writing about advertising or talking about advertising, I may be arguing from a particular corner, but I'm always conscious of the danger that I may trap myself by kind of making it sound more simple than it really is. And if we ever end up just saying, well, it's all about this, or it's all about that, or the only thing you need to know is this, I think you're in danger of then sort of missing things. And I suppose that is the sense in which advertising has always been an art as well as a science. Or as you put it earlier, perhaps better, it's a craft. Craft rather than an art is a better expression for it, because at the end of the day, it exists to achieve
a result,
particular purpose, rather than art, which is, you know, art for art's sake or whatever.
Right.
Craft is a better word, but it's that there are aspects of it that are judgmental. There are aspects of it that are aesthetic, and so on. Yeah.
That's very good, very good. Like to summarize a little bit, like what you said, like the one thing was like these narratives that shape our thinking, and one of them is this enlightenment narrative that you talked about. Everything before was primitive, and now we become sophisticated because we have found something, and it always like overclaims of what it does. Like in like 20 years ago or like 15 years ago, suddenly neuromarketing came about, and it did it was looking for the buy button. Like that was the first understanding, and obviously it just it just made something visible that seasoned practitioners, successful practitioners like yourself have done in the past. And suddenly you could see in the brain that, yeah, it reacts a little bit differently. Like, and a surprising examples were like that the brain actually is working less when it perceives a strong brand. So that means that there's like a reduction of complexity that brands achieve. Okay, this is interesting. This is really good, but it doesn't make obsolete everything that was before. And then what you describe there, like the golden age narrative, like with the DDB, what you found very dangerous, which we also follow today, like advertisers for advertisers, that they celebrate themselves, like, and they live in a bubble and don't think about what their original purpose is, like strong brands that make sure that people keep their jobs and that value is created in the future, and instead they celebrate their own causes. And then there was the third narrative that you mentioned, was the year zero narrative. And I recently had a great example of that. I was at a marketing conference, and there was this marketing guru from the US, and he basically said, like, since COVID, any market research you did before that was done before COVID, just put it in the bin. It's over. It's like it's all obsolete. Like, from now on, everything changes. And these narratives, I recognize when I read like you wrote about them, I recognize them in so many conversations, and they're all not true. And So what I liked to structure that a little bit like the second book, the Why Does the Peddler Sing? You dive in deeper. Like the first one is basically also researching like the history of advertising, where it comes from, the different thinking, and then in my way it's like the second edition of the Anatomy of Humbug, because you look at the role of what does creativity actually mean, and in Cannes everybody uses this word like excessively. And you write here, misled by managerial myths of rationality and logic, and by cultish misunderstanding of creativity. I love that very much. So tell us a little bit about your perspective on creativity, and you use a famous campaign that you created for the Barclays card. That was the beginning of the story, where you openly disclosed how that award-winning campaign came about.
Yeah. Well, I think the word creativity, I mean, when I started writing the book, I really did not want to use the word creativity at all. And in fact, for the first three quarters of the book, I don't use the word creativity. And I point that out. And I said, you know, there were times when I was tempted to use the word creativity, but after a moment's thought, I found that another word would be more precise and express better what I wanted to say. So you can actually do very well without the word creativity. There's usually another word that explains better what you actually mean. And then as I got towards the end of the book, I changed my point of view a bit, honestly, from a rather pragmatic point of view, that I thought people are perhaps more likely to buy a book that has creativity on the cover, because they always want to hear about creativity. So I gave it the subtitle, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. What creativity really means in advertising.
And I sort of confronted the word head on, and I wrote about where does this word come from and how have we used it? And I mean, I think that it's a bit like what I was saying, you know, that this whole sort of history where advertising sort of started taking itself too seriously and started kind of fetishizing itself almost, which only happens around the 1960s. The word creativity in English, it only really becomes at all used from about the 1960s onwards. And it's very much sort of the Birnbach era where they start making a big thing of it. David Ogilvy, as late as the 1980s, David Ogilvy wrote, "You will not find the word creativity in the Oxford English Dictionary," which is the, you know, most authoritative dictionary of English in the UK. And he was absolutely right. I mean, I've looked it up and it's not there. So it's quite a neologism from that point of view. And I dug into the history of the word creativity, and I found this. There's a lot of things said about creativity, a lot of strange ideas about what creativity means in different contexts. But one thing I found is there are sort of two fundamentally different meanings of the word creativity when you look at it historically. One is the sense that you are creating something original and innovative, which is fair enough, except if that's what you mean, you can usually use the words original or innovative, and they quite clearly mean what you say. So if it's coming up with, you know, a new way to build a mousetrap or something, you can say that's an innovative solution or a creative, an original solution. You don't particularly need to say it's a creative solution, but that points the meaning of creativity in a particular direction, which is to do with originality and just being different and doing something that's never been done before. But actually, the other meaning of creativity is to do with what we have come to know as the creative arts. And it's kind of a code word, particularly in a business context, for something that's essentially aesthetic. You know, it's something like a poem or a novel or a song or a picture. These are creative activities. Mm. Now, I think these two things get very muddled up. And I think the sense in which it's important and potentially relevant for advertising is actually that aesthetic dimension, because it's in that realm of aesthetics that we are creating the kind of things that will appeal to people's emotions, things that will appeal to their memories, things that will create compelling, distinctive assets. And that side of it is the side that interests me. But we need to sort of distinguish that from just being different for the sake of being different, because I think that leads you down a quite dangerous route, which leads you in terms of saying, oh, it's all about zigging while the others zag, and it's all
that
about
leads you to moldy whoppers, for example.
Yes, and just being shocking. For the sake of being shocking. And while that sometimes goes hand in hand with being effective, it very often doesn't, because the reality is that in any sort of aesthetic tradition, and I think this is as true of advertising as anything else. It's certainly true in the field of popular culture, as I try to show in the book, that what appeals to people is not something that is completely different and completely shocking and completely outlandish, but something that gets just the right balance between familiarity and novelty.
And you mentioned David Ogilvy.
It's within a context of something that is already familiar. That's what people enjoy, and that's what touches people. That's what's meaningful to people.
Right, and you mentioned David Ogilvy, who said basically, like, you know, great people always contradict themselves. Like he said this, or supposedly said, like, if you have nothing new to say, sing it. So the content is familiar, but the way it's delivered is creative in that way, like the way you deliver the message. But people do want, like, and that's what brands are about. It's not always about, like, really delivering the difference, because, you know, technologically, what is really different today? And if it's different for 1 month, in 6 months, it's not going to be different anymore. So it's about reinforcing certain memory structures, and a creative way of doing that obviously gets more attention. So in that way, creativity is useful. Do I understand you correctly there?
Yes, I mean, I said at one point, I would be quite happy if we never use the word creativity again, but that's not going to happen. So we had better decide what we want that word to mean. Mm. And I end up with a sort of manifesto for creativity. And I say, what creativity needs to mean in advertising is, you know, the artistry and the craft of creating something that is popular and appealing to people, and, you know, and memorable, and that is all that great advertising really needs to do. And if it doesn't do that, then it's really not doing its job.
Yeah. That's very interesting, and it's fascinating to talk to you. The time goes by so fast, but I would like to do this little switch back to the Barclay campaign, because I didn't know the campaign, but the way you described how it came about made so much sense in my understanding how brands achieve today to create memory structures which are filled with emotion. And then people feel that emotion, and there's a mental connection with a certain topic. In that case, it was a credit card. And then people basically switch to a search mode why that emotion is correct. And they will find reasons to convince themselves that the feeling is correct. But the feeling comes first, and then Yes. The convincing comes afterwards. And that campaign does that really, really, really well. Is like just from the way you described how the storyline went, and then the inception of that campaign is a story in itself. Would you like to just not completely, and then I advise everybody to buy your book because it's so well described. But if you would like to share a little bit of that, it would be great.
Well, thank you. I mean, yes, there's two quite long chapters about this Barclay Card campaign, which I was very involved in the early 1990s. And I think the one of the main points about the campaign is that we pitched for and we won the account, as you do in advertising agencies, with a completely different creative idea. And then we started trying to make the ads, and for all sorts of reasons, it became problematic. The research showed that the public didn't like the ads very much. We had real problems with the cost of what were going to be some very expensive commercials. We had copy clearance TV people saying you can't show this and you can't show that. And anyway, I mean, it was all, but the whole campaign was based on a very sort of rational kind of argument and a slogan. It was like, you know, this is the only credit card you'll ever need because. And we were kind of working fundamentally in a very sort of left brain, rather pedestrian way. And it was only at the very last minute that we were kind of forced into doing something completely different. And I mean, with, to be honest, a certain amount of good luck, the idea of using Rowan Atkinson came about. And we then got in touch with Rowan Atkinson. And we found that Rowan Atkinson was keen to do a particular character. And I think what actually shifted, and it kind of needed the crisis to make the shift for us, it shifted us from thinking in terms of let's do an ad that tells people why this product is better, to doing something that is actually going to be genuinely entertaining and popular. And I mean, of course, we did both, but I think it was the fact that we started thinking in terms of this is show business rather than we're doing an ad that turned this into one of the most successful campaigns that probably I've ever worked on. And indeed, it's probably still today the only campaign that most people will remember for Barclay Card in the UK, as long as they're old enough. And they're still very, very funny commercials, beautifully crafted and shot, you know, very much actively designed and created by Rowan Atkinson and his producer, John Lloyd, in the same way that it would have done a TV show.
Right, and it was basically taking the character Johnny English,
it was a precursor of Johnny English before that finally arrived, but that was kind of like his original sketchbook for Johnny English, if you like.
And they were basically like comedy pieces, like with him and his assistant, and he, like being the Johnny English character, always knows everything better and is super. And then the assistant had the Barclay card and always solved the problem of the superhero secret agent that didn't know how to solve the problems. And that drove home messages like insurance with the car and other messages.
Yeah. And it's, and I mean, they did all the things that ads are expected to do. They told you about the product benefit. They were full of mentions of the brand name. This is another thing to notice if you watch these films. I mean, again, There are an awful lot of creative people nowadays who seem to think it's desperately uncool to mention the brand name at all in the advert. But you look at these ads, and I mean, Rowan Atkinson said, Barclay card, both Barclay card. What do I need to use a Barclay card for? It's like completely effortlessly, he gets all these mentions of the brand name in. So you can't miss what it is they're talking about, but you don't really notice it because you're just laughing all the time.
Yeah, and then you're in the field of Jenny Romaniuk, who's going to be on the show as well, and who has done some really amazing work in researching how important it is to have a strong brand coding. Yeah, like the stronger your brand is coded, the better everything performs that you invest in media.
Absolutely, so, I think her work is really important. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there you included a Howard Gossage quote in the end of the book, which I found very good and a good example of what you just described. So basically, you were entertaining people; these were comedy pieces, and by doing that, you basically they allowed you to put the brand name into their memory. Yeah. So yep. And Howard Gossage said the buying of time and space is not taking out a hunting license on someone's private preserve, but the rent of a stage on which we may perform.
Yes.
Yeah, and
I like that quote very much.
Yeah. And that explains that very well. Oh, it's fantastic. So thank you very much for sharing all those already insights from the book. But again, I will put the books in the show notes, and I can anybody in advertising or marketing I advise to read this book. This is money well spent and also time well spent, because I haven't found anywhere such a comprehensive look and deep dive into what is the thinking behind the effectiveness of advertising. And you did a great job there.
Well, so, thank you. That was what I hoped to do.
You did. I mean, for me, you did. It's always, like we know, communication and brand communication is always context dependent, but I don't know, you did the trick. Absolutely. And so looking back on your long career, I would like to finish up with something like you are a mentor and a coach as well. So, if you would mentor the young Paul who fell in love with advertising and is determined to make a career in it today, what would be your key advice?
Oh, goodness. What would I say to myself? I find it difficult to answer that question. It's a kind of a thought experiment that I struggle with, because I think I never knew where my life was going, and I'm not sure I ever would have benefited from knowing. I mean, if I'd been told when I went into the business, you know, you'll still be giving an interview about advertising to somebody in Germany in 50 years' time, I've probably been horrified. But that's the way it's turned out, and I have no regrets about it at all. So I suppose I would just want to say to myself, you know, hang on in there. It's, you know, carry on doing this as long as it's interesting for you. And you might be surprised how long that is.
Yeah. And did you have like a model for yourself when you came to crossroads where you had to make a decision? Was there like a certain way that you thought about how to make a decision?
Probably. Again, hard to answer. I mean, I look back on my life sometimes and I think, at one level it seems very unadventurous, because I literally stayed at the same agency for over 30 years. And then when I was in a position to leave the agency, I kind of just settled down to doing a bit of consultancy and writing and seeing what came along. There's never been much of a grand plan, I'm afraid, but I guess by just sort of sitting around and seeing what came up next, I've maybe been very fortunate or very opportunistic, because it seemed that something interesting did always come along next.
Yeah, I mean, like in the beginning, I listed all those education, all the degrees that you gained. Like, you're a lifelong learner. I mean, that's something that's written all over your curriculum vitae. Basically, it's like looking at what's next and what can I learn more. Yeah, it's like to stay curious.
That's
would
true.
Be something.
I mean, that I guess that is what sort of keeps me excited. Is you know, either learning or writing. you know, to discover what I think about something, writing is the best way of doing that. Yeah, that's what makes me want to get up in the morning, I guess.
Yeah. And if you like the consulting that you do right now, like, do you see something coming up that brands should watch out for, like in the challenges ahead? Now we just had COVID, okay, and some people say everything changes with COVID, which is not true, because people's brains don't change in 2 years. But then we have a war coming, and we have technological changes at, like everybody always said, like in our times things have changed quicker than ever. Everybody always said it, but this time we're talking here about 3, 4, 5 different influences that come at the same time and become ripe, like artificial intelligence and all that. Could you give us like what's in it for you? Like if you could, you have the in a fairy tale, you know, how do you call it, the genie out of the bottle? If you could like rub the bottle and wish for the perfect client that gives you what you just described, the challenge of learning and enjoying and at the same time solving something which you see coming up.
Oh gosh, that's a big question. I mean, I suppose in answer to your sort of slightly earlier thought, yes, I mean, there are a lot of very alarming things happening in the world at the moment, and I'm not kind of relaxed about any of them. You know, we have a war in Europe. We have serious problems with climate change. We are currently going through, you know, a real cost of living crisis wherever we are, with you know, threats to the supplies of all the things we depend on. I mean, this is all quite worrying, and it makes me feel in a way just very grateful that having lived in the decades that I have lived, I realize in the course of, you know, world history, I've probably lived most of my life through one of the most stable and prosperous periods in European history, and indeed one of the most sort of stable periods in advertising as well. It was a great time to be in advertising. So yes, I mean, things change. Things do really change, and we have to adapt to them. There are some long-term changes that will be the result of COVID, but they're not fundamental changes, but they may be important changes. Like, and many people are never going to go back to 5-day weeks in the office. It has made us much more used to, you know, buying things and having them delivered to our homes rather than going to shops. These are real shifts, and they will really make a difference. But, you know, they're kind of obvious in a way. We just have to adapt to those strategically and not kid ourselves.
Can I just segue there, because coming back to a very early thought we had in this conversation about purpose, there are really fundamental changes going on politically, environmentally, and so on. What role do you see that brands can play? Like, what positive roles can brands play, and should they actually take up this agenda in some way or other?
Yeah, that's a massive question. I haven't got.
Yeah, we still got 5 minutes.
I think you know, in terms of any company, I think at a sort of deep level should consider within the context of what it does, how can it do this in a way that, you know, minimizes its bad impacts and improves its good impacts. And that's across a whole range of things. But I always think, you know, any corporate program of ethics probably should begin with things like pay your taxes, treat your staff well, treat your suppliers well, treat your customers well, don't exploit people. Once you've done all that, then you can start thinking about how do we minimize our impact on the environment, which is generally possible to do and actually very often a win-win, because doing that will also, I mean, on the one hand, it will make you compliant with increasing government regulation. It'll probably save you money as well. There's plenty of things to do there. I don't think it is the role of businesses to try and legislate on lots of other things. And I think there's a great deal of what goes on that is not just sort of ineffectual virtue signaling, if you like, but very often is sort of potentially even dangerous, in the sense that it is not the role of the people who make our hamburgers or our soft drinks to tell us how to live our lives, in a moral sense, because that very often is one agenda versus another. And of course, I mean, there are many things that worry me about the world at the moment. The way in which, we are increasingly polarized into rival tribes who, simply have no means of having meaningful dialogue with each other, other than wanting to kill each other. That's very worrying, because most of the answers to most of the difficult questions are more nuanced, and yet it's becoming increasingly difficult to have a nuanced debate. But I think on the whole, the talk of brand purpose beyond those basics is often a massive distraction.
I understand. But in this, what you just said, this polarized world, like, to make advertising popular, famous and fun again, like you say, is also not like as easy as it maybe used to be, because there's always one group, like fun and humor is often like edgy also. Yeah. And the chance of hurting somebody with a joke is so much bigger than ever before. So it's not easy to navigate these waters, also for brands. And so they become a little bit overly serious and overly purpose driven, maybe also from that.
Yeah, no, I acknowledge that has become a difficulty, but it's something that each brand has to negotiate its way for itself. And I think that is possibly an area where any business has to sort of can have a position on what it thinks is acceptable and what it thinks is not acceptable. I think there's not necessarily a single answer to any of those things. And it's still possible to do work that's popular and entertaining without necessarily being edgy.
That leads me to my last, second to last question is, what do you hope for? What do you see for yourself? What do you hope for yourself for the next years? But what do you hope for as a development?
I would like to see the advertising industry, whatever it looks like in the future, as being, going back to being more focused on doing stuff that does what it's meant to do, really, that is effective for the clients and ideally not too irritating for the public. and at the moment, I think it's far from both those things.
Right. And many people in advertising are ashamed to be in advertising. I think that's something that is a bad sign also. It's like they don't see the value in
what they do. To be ashamed is not a good place to be, yeah. I think, if that's how you feel, maybe you're not in the right place.
That's it. Yeah, I would say the same thing. So one tip I would like still from you, what resource would you point your listeners to besides your own books? But what film, book, or other inspiration would you say this is something to check out? Which book, for example, have you gifted often besides your own?
Oh well, yeah. Let me think. I mean, apart from the obvious ones, everyone should read Byron Sharp if they haven't, and everyone should look at Orlando Wood's books, which are really interesting. But if you want to go slightly off-piste, I would suggest it would be interesting now to look back at the book called, let me just see what its actual title is. It's on my bookshelf right here. I would go back to a book that came out a few years ago called Anti-Fragile by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. And indeed, I should reread it myself because I think it was, he's a very interesting guy. And I think he's pointing very presciently towards a lot of the problems that the world is facing at the moment.
Absolutely.
So there's a tip.
There's a tip. And I can support that strongly. He recently wrote another book called Skin in the Game, and he has some amazing insights. Yeah, that's a very good tip. So the last question. You have a chance to put a screensaver on everybody, of all the people responsible for brands in Europe, for 1 month on their computer. What would it say?
I think I would have their screensaver playing playing the ad for Dédale's socks from Slovakia. And you can look that one up.
Dédale's socks from Slovakia. Okay. Yeah. We'll have to check that out. Thank you very much. Paul, this was truly an amazing hour with you. My sincere thanks for your time. And I wish you all the best for your endeavors and maybe hoping for another book because I enjoyed yours a lot. Thank you very much.
I hope there will be another one at some point. And thank you, Olaf. Bye.
Thank you very much. Und das war eine weitere Episode von Markenkraft. Vielen Dank, dass Sie dabei waren. Wir hoffen, es hat Ihnen genauso viel Freude gemacht wie uns. Wenn ja, empfehlen Sie uns, Ihren Freunden, Ihren Bekannten, Ihren Kollegen und bewerten Sie uns auf iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Soundcloud, egal wo Sie diesen Podcast hören. Share the love for brands. Machen Sie es gut für sich und die Menschen in Ihrem Leben.